Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently. Today's episode is in partnership with Lawbroker, legal's first customer experience platform powered by lawyers. Lawbroker is a recommendation and matching platform that helps drive new business to solo and small practices throughout Canada. With its mission to simplify the accessibility of legal services, Lawbroker has built a platform that mimics everyday consumer applications, bringing familiarity and convenience to the legal industry. As a lawyer, you make the first move, opening up an entirely new revenue stream for your practice, all while putting you in control of your own demand.
Today, we are joined by Erin Baer. Erin previously summered, articled, and practiced on Bay Street, where he became an equity partner at the age of 29. Needless to say, Erin's career started off as anything but off the tracks. Nowadays, Erin is the co-founder of 4L Academy, a modern legal training program for law students and lawyers, and the co-founder of Build Your Book, a course and podcast which teaches primarily lawyers modern business development skills. He is also a partner at Renault & Co., a boutique law firm dubbed Canada's Digital Law Firm. Erin often shares his expertise and wisdom through LinkedIn, so we are so excited to have him on the show. It feels like we are meeting a LinkedIn celebrity. So thank you so much for joining us, especially for recording with us on a Friday evening. So we are so grateful to have you here on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. And I chose this time, so more than happy to be here right now.
Awesome. So Erin, can you tell us a little bit how your career has evolved over time? We know that you started out at one firm for a vast majority of your career thus far, and then your career has seemingly rapidly evolved really quickly after leaving the firm. And we'd love to hear a bit more about.
Yeah, so I mean, some of it was a long time coming. So I probably should have left my old firm many years before. If my wife had her way and if I was smart enough to listen to her, I would have. But in some ways, I also left at the right time. So I became a partner in early 2020, pandemic hit. And just a confluence of factors sort of built up towards me leaving. But you know, along the way, it was really linear on paper, as you sort of alluded to, 1L, 2L, 3L, articling, you know, associate, became a partner. But behind the scenes, things were not super linear. I was sort of living the prescribed day job, you know, billing hours, doing what I was supposed to do to keep the firm happy. But I was also dabbling in a bunch of stuff back then. So I got really into the legal tech space in about my second year as a lawyer. And I'd sort of already at that point gotten frustrated by how law seemed to be practiced by colleagues, by the industry in general, and knew there had to be better ways. And this legal tech industry was just coming up then, especially in Toronto. And I was the guy reaching out unprompted to these companies going, hey, like, can I see a demo? Like, what do you do? You know, I wanted to figure out how I could leverage them to help my clients, well, at that time, the firm's clients, but also help my practice, like do a lot less grunt work and just add more value to clients. So got to know a lot of people in that space and thought at one point in time I would make a move there, almost quit practicing 3 or 4 years in to go do like a full-time legal tech kind of role for a big firm and decided not to do that, which was a good choice. Just based on where I ended up. So I became a partner, but was still super frustrated with most of the way the law was practiced, how younger lawyers were being treated, the profession in general, and sort of started dabbling in LinkedIn early in the pandemic because our firm said, yeah, people should use social media. And I figured, okay, well, the exec committee who doesn't know how to use any of these things is definitely not going to be leading the charge here. So I might as well lead the charge in my practice group. So I created a fun little challenge to inspire our group and gamify it a bit. And most people quit, but since I didn't want to be a hypocrite and I was leading the charge, I figured I would have to post. And through that, I ended up building a fun little presence on LinkedIn, which has allowed me to do a lot of the stuff that I launched in the last couple of years, which is 4L Academy and Build Your Book, which we can chat a lot more about. But basically, lots of complaints for a while. It was finally time to stop complaining and see what I could do in reality. And so far, so good. It's been a ton of work, but definitely enjoyed every moment of it.
Yeah. So how did you make that transition? Did you have any support in place or any mentors that helped you sort of take that leap from the traditional path to where you are now?
I had one good mentor internally, informal mentor at my old firm who was super supportive and actually telling me like, you need to quit basically. What are you doing? Like do this. So and at one point he was like, you should start your own firm. And I thought he was delusional. I'm like, that was the last thing on my mind. Like it was definitely challenging to leave. Like I liked my colleagues. I liked the work I was doing and I was comfortable in the sense like I spent basically a decade from summer student on in the same place. Right. So, you know, anytime you're you know, taking that plunge, there's risk there. And I had definitely resisted taking that plunge for a while, even though I knew it was sort of the right move. It was pretty obvious. And I would be on calls. There was one day where like three different people I talked to were like, why haven't you left yet? And I was just like making excuses. Like there were reasons to stay, but there were also such obvious reasons to leave. And I think a lot of people I was talking to realized like I was just ahead of where most of the firms were in terms of the way I saw the industry. And I was one of the last holdouts sort of in the big law space. Most people had left, but it was an interesting space because I was an ally for a lot of these legal tech companies from the inside. And that's sort of what I was trying to do is like, how can I help, you know, these people gain more adoption as somebody who's really interested in the space, but also practicing like a user of the tool and an advocate and someone on these interesting conversations that were going on. But eventually for me, it was time to be my own boss and not be told no and not have to listen to it. And it was a needed time. And there unfortunately was not support for what I wanted to do on these initiatives. And so there was really no choice. The options were stay and literally not be allowed to mentor and teach and do all these things I'm passionate about, whether paid or unpaid, or leave and, you know, finally take some risks. So the choice to leave was pretty much made for me at that point. And then it was just a question of where to go and what to do. And somehow we got to where we are today.
Okay, wow. So not only did you leave, but then you started 4L Academy, you started Build Your Book, you joined a new firm. Can you tell us a bit more about 4L Academy and Build Your Book and how you've grown both while also practicing at Renault & Co. and, you know, probably living a full life outside of all of these initiatives as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, one advantage of being based in Toronto, especially during the pandemic, was there was nothing to do because the city was shut down. So the opportunity cost of trying stuff was really low. And so I sort of leaned into that. I get bored pretty easily. And so one thing I have not been at all throughout the pandemic has been bored, which was a real luxury in the early days when I think most of us were sort of losing our minds a bit at home. So I also completely underestimated the time commitments for all these things and all of that. So, you know, would not recommend doing all of these three things at the same time. It was a little hectic for sure last June. So I left my old firm on May 31st, started up my new firm June 1st. And that week, we were also launching our trial classes for 4L Academy, going live the week after. This was not the plan. My plan was to leave my old firm in August, but long story short, expedited timeline. And so it was sort of rush, rush, rush. And then on top of that, I was bringing a lot of clients over who needed to have a seamless experience from one day to the next. Like there wasn't this opportunity to really take time off and all of that. So again, wouldn't recommend it, but it was all stuff I was really passionate about. And so 4L Academy is a modern training company focusing for now on summer students, articling students, and, you know, first couple of years associates. Over time, the idea is really to go from summer student all the way through to like fifth, sixth year associate. And basically building out the training I wish I had and really what law school probably should have done. So I think it's trite to say law school typically does not prepare you to practice law. That seems to be accepted. There are some schools like Ryerson, Lincoln Alexander, and University of Calgary that are doing some really good jobs with some more innovative stuff. And the other schools are tinkering a bit. But by and large, the core curriculum, I think we can all agree, doesn't prepare you to practice law. Piper, you know well, the bar exam is not exactly measuring ability to practice law. And so it's pretty accepted that when you get to a firm, you have no idea what you're doing. No matter what kind of law, but especially on the corporate side. And so firms acknowledge that. And no one there really has the time to train. Like the more experienced lawyers, it's non-billable, right? Like when you find those great mentors who go out of their way to help you, they're sacrificing their own time or their own pay or things like that. And obviously, huge respect for people I had who did that for me. But by and large, the system is not set up to train you. And the training that exists is definitely, in most cases, not pedagogically the best. So very much lectures, PowerPoints, whatever. There's not a lot of practical stuff. There's not a lot of simulations and things like that. And so for me, when I started going up the curve, especially in my third or fourth year, it was super challenging from a mental health standpoint. And I was really anxious because I had no idea what I was doing and I wanted to help the clients. And I was being asked to do work I was not ready to do without the support that I needed. And clients were asking me, you know, what's normal? And I'm like, I don't even know how this thing works in the first place, not to mention what's normal. Like, I can't, like, you should not be hiring me effectively to do this. And that was anxiety inducing because, like, you sign a contract, like, you can't take it back 2 months later and say to the other side, hey, sorry, I had no clue what I was doing. I sort of screwed over my client. You've got a binding agreement that isn't, you know, easily amendable or cannot easily be amended, I guess. So Through that process, I said to myself, like, there's two options. I either like take some time off, but if I do that, I knew I was never going to come back to practicing. Like, it would just build up the mental block in my head, or I power through it, you know, learn, you know, go to therapy, learn how to deal with, you know, real life and all these things, learn some strategies. And then on top of that, learn a ton. And so I spent hundreds of hours self-teaching, reading all sorts of stuff out there, books, practical law, like you name it. And then reaching out to informal mentors at my firm who were really gracious with their time. And I'm like, hey, I have 100 questions for you on this topic. Can you spare an hour? Because I was trying to build this mental map in my head of like, what am I doing and why am I doing it? And that's what I was lacking. And that's what most lawyers are lacking. And so once I built that map in my head and understood what I was doing, I was like, this is not that hard. But also, why didn't you teach me this way in the first place? Like, this is what I needed. It's like law school where you get to the final exam and you're supposed to throw this all together and figure out how this works. You're like, wasn't that your job as a professor? Like, why is that my job to do that? You know? And so started running a lot of informal training at my old firm, and that was going really well, and like all no credit, stuff like that. But long story short, spoke to tons of other people and just heard the same story over and over again of the mental health impact of leaving the profession, of all this sort of stuff. And I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. Like, why are we accepting that you're just supposed to feel really stressed and anxious and then leave? Like this isn't rocket science, but we got to do this by completely rethinking how we train, doing it in a modern way, and doing it in a way that's pedagogically sound. So we could chat more about it, but we really focus on like the why. Like, the why is the most important part that I think is lacking in so much training, and then doing it in a much more hands-on way that's fun and engaging and practical, and nothing like law school and nothing like typical firm training or typical CPD.
Yeah. Wow. So that is very interesting. And I think something to think about too is, yes, as young lawyers or new lawyers or recent calls, imposter syndrome is a really big problem, but sometimes it also is, we don't know what we don't know, and we don't know how to do those things that we don't know. And so that can add on to an immense level of stress and anxiety. And so courses like this seem really valuable in kind of arming new calls and recent calls in how to do the thing. So it takes a little bit of pressure off and helps train in a more logical way that can actually help them run their practice and feel more confident. So it's really interesting to hear how you've been able to do that, because I think that would be really interesting if it expanded to other areas of law, immigration and employment, if you're ever thinking of expanding practice areas, you know, anything like that. I think it would be so cool.
We actually started really broad. We've actually narrowed a bit just because what we realized is like we got to focus on a core thing. So we started broad. Yes. We started with litigation. We were going to dabble in immigration, this and that. And then we made the, I think, finally sensible choice to say, you know what? We're getting too scattered. Let's focus on one thing. And once we've mastered that, then let's move back to the other areas, because we also teach in a really atypical way. Like, we're actually in the process right now of onboarding new teachers. And like, we're running our own boot camp for those teachers on how to teach our way, because if we just let anyone design courses, what we've realized is like, it's not going to work with our style and our brand. So we're learning how to teach other teachers in addition to how to build courses and then how to run them. So it's been this really interesting educational piece, but really I always say like, we're a mental health, you know, like we're a training company, but like really we're a mental health company. Like at the end of the day, it's reducing that stress, reducing that anxiety, which we know is a huge challenge in this profession, especially on the younger side, but just in general. And, you know, the piece I feel like nobody is talking about is, if you have no idea what you're doing, it's no wonder you're anxious. Like that's just common sense. And so that piece has been missed so much. And then of course, there's all the other, you know, fun in this profession that contributes to that stress and anxiety, but the lack of training and the lack of knowing what you're doing is so underrated in my mind, at least in terms of the mental health impact. And it's a huge, huge problem.
Yeah. And then I just wanted to ask as well. So you said you were reading different books and stuff. Do you have any recommendations on good books to read?
Yeah. So read a lot of practical law, huge fan of practical law in general. Didn't exist when I was a first or second year lawyer, wish it had. I read all sorts of stuff. Ken Adams' book on contract drafting. I read various books on corporate law. Just really, I'm like, okay, like there's all these secondary sources out there. And that was something I read a lot more of in law school as well, is I was not the person who read a lot of cases. I stopped doing that in like Canadian Thanksgiving at first year. I was like, this seems like a waste of time. But I would read the secondary sources because I'm like, I need to figure out like, how does this connect together? And those books, like the I don't know if you ever read The Essentials of Law or Urban Law Essential Series, like I found those books really helpful. And, you know, most law students were focused on just what they were told to read. I was like, this isn't going to help me. I need to understand the big picture here. And it's no different. There's so many secondary sources and there's a lot of decent content out there. The challenge is finding the time. And so what we've tried to do with a lot of the courses is just like mesh it all together in a really smart way that's getting people to understand and then apply it. Because you don't have time if you're billing all these hours, and especially the last couple of years with how busy firms have been. Like in an ideal world, yeah, you just read all these books, but it's just not practical. And the reality is, you know, I was reading all these things on top of working a significant amount. So it was not for the average person, but to me, it was the only way I was going to make it through was to learn my way out of it.
So Aaron, so much of how your career has evolved has been because of mentorship. So because of the ways that you've built mentorship systems, or because of mentorship you did or maybe didn't receive. So we're wondering, what kind of advice would you give to current law students or new calls at the very beginning of their careers who are just starting out and really kind of need that push and need it? Like, what would you tell yourself starting out?
There's definitely a lot of people out there who want to help. I mean, I think most lawyers, and maybe both of you have experienced this, like if you reach out, they're generally pretty good. Like some will obviously ignore you, but on average, people will respond. And so it can sometimes feel like you're infringing on people's time or these people are so busy, but often they're willing to give up their time to help. I am starting to learn to guard my calendar a bit more just because the number of requests I get is just, I wish I could satisfy them all. So I'm these days saying no to a lot more one-on-one things. But generally speaking, you will find people that are happy to talk and are just happy to help. And it's easiest to reach out when you're truly not looking for a job. So like if you have that job lined up, for example, and you truly want to understand stuff better, people will be happy to help with that because they know what it was like in your shoes. So I say, you know, try to find someone who's got something in common, whether they went to the same school, similar background, you know, that's a good way to reach out if it's a cold message. You might find LinkedIn gets you higher response rates than emails. It totally depends. But reach out. You know, I came from a family of nobody who was a lawyer. I knew nothing. I could maybe have named one law firm when I started law school. Like I had no idea what I was doing. So let's just say knowing these things and knowing how the system works would be a lot more helpful because there's just so much, you know, this unwritten advice. And I think with Farrell Academy, what we've also tried to do, we've cut back a tiny bit on it right now, but we're going to pick more up, is build these kind of guides or have these sessions all for free to try to sort of replace what there wasn't. So like we created this OCI guide that's like, I don't know, 50 pages or whatever. It's literally like all this informal stuff that certain people used to have, just papering it from the views of the students, but also people who have been on the other side for, you know, a decade plus. For 1Ls, I hosted 3 events in the first semester. So I did like an event in late August, like, hey, you know, panel advice from people who are in law school currently on what you wish you knew. And then we follow that up 6 weeks later. It's like, cool, now you've been in law school and I know you didn't apply half that advice because easier said than done. All right, let's talk about what you what you should have been doing, what you want to sort of, you know, recalibrate on. And then before exams, we ran a massive exam prep session being like, here's what no one is telling you about how to actually write exams. And then we just reran that one a couple of weeks ago. So there's lots more we want to be doing, whether it's, you know, that session before you start your summer job or whatever it is. It's like all these things where it doesn't need to be one-on-one. And often everyone is looking for the same stuff. How do I do X? And so how do we offer that to people for free in a way where we're sort of democratizing the knowledge and taking away some of the unfair advantages that people have depending on the background they come from, which really isn't fair. And this is definitely not an equitable profession at the best of times. So, you know, trying to do our part to make it more of a level playing field for everybody.
Yeah. And I also think a lot of those things that I kind of learned from others at law school, or, you know, the information that sort of trickled down, was usually when we were like standing waiting for class to start, or like when we were physically in person, you just sort of like hear these things and learn what you're supposed to do. But in a digital law firm or a law school era, you've kind of lost all of that. So even any chance of you accidentally understanding what the heck is going on has been taken away. So I think it's extra important that in the absence of those sort of like hallway chats and everything, that it be paperized or, you know, I can't remember what the exact term you used, but I like that.
Yeah, one quick thing there. I know you may want to move on, but one of the things I've seen firms, I just literally got off a call with an article student like an hour ago. unfortunately, in this like hybrid virtual world, like every time people are like, oh, it's so hard, I'm like, I don't believe this for a second. Like, what's hard is when you don't create the systems to allow younger lawyers, especially article students, whatever, to have the opportunity to reach out because they're so worried about infringing and they feel like everyone's too busy. And like one of the ideas I had 2 years ago that no one bothered listening to, I was like, it's not hard. Let's literally create a Google Sheet or something where the lawyers in our group can say, hey, like, let's choose Thursday from 4 to 5 or whatever. And we're like, we are free. You can book our slots. You are not infringing. Like, it's not that hard, but just creating the opportunity so that the people that are really cognizant and trying not to impede on people's time don't have to feel like they're being a burden. Like, there are so many ways to do this, create these checkpoints, you know, like being proactive, but it's got to come from the people that are more senior, because so many of the younger lawyers, the students, like, they're doing the right thing. And some people are more aggressive and more comfortable reaching out and doing this stuff. And honestly, that's probably the right move. But you know, you want to make everyone feel comfortable. And I think with Foral Academy, you know, keep hearing like, oh, mentorship is so hard, training is so hard virtual. I'm like, it's not. You just have to be deliberate about it. And you have to rethink how you're doing it before. And unfortunately, I don't think there's been enough time put into that. And the result is people are feeling they're not getting the mentorship, they're not getting the training, they're not having these conversations. But like, I can tell you, like, I've had thousands, like probably, maybe not thousands, well over 1,000 one-on-one conversations with people virtually in the last 2 years. I made all these relationships. Like, you just have to be deliberate about it. And the onus can't be on the people, the lowest ranking people at a firm to do that. It's just not fair.
That is an excellent point. And just to pivot a little bit from the 4L course to build your book, and something that I am notoriously bad at, and potentially other new recent calls are hesitant to dive into, is business development. So can you talk a little bit more about build your book and business development in general, and what tips you would have for recent calls like myself or anyone at any stage in their career on how to build your book?
Yeah. So I went to business school before law school, and there were no sales courses, but even if there were, I wouldn't have taken them because I would have said sales is not for me. Sales is like, you know, a low class kind of thing. It's not a professional thing. Like, sales was just sort of frowned upon at the business school I went to, which is ironic because firstly, sales can be crazy lucrative these days, but more importantly, everyone eventually becomes a salesperson if you run your own business, if you're a lawyer. And it turns out it's a very valuable and very transferable skill. Didn't realize that. And sales is still a dirty word in the legal profession, which is a shame. We call it business development because sales sounds too aggressive, which tells you all you need to know about sales training or business development training in the legal profession. So early in my career, my plan was to go in-house. Like, I figured I'm, you know, going to join our firm's corporate commercial group, and in 2 years I'll go in-house and work less, and I like business and, you know, all that stuff. And that never sort of happened. And so along the way, sort of became a partner by accident. And I was like, okay, yeah, business development seems to be this thing that's important. No idea really how to do this. But I watched a lot of lawyers I used to work with and was like, hey, whatever they're doing, I definitely don't want to emulate. And we'd have our annual training. And I was like, this is not replicable. This is not scalable. This is just like, you know, go hand your resume to a company. That's how you get jobs kind of advice. I'm like, that advice is a little dated here. So I was trying to figure out, like, how do I, like, where do I look for advice as a lawyer on how to grow my practice as a younger lawyer who, you know, has some connections, but is not like inheriting a book of business. It's not getting all these clients from their family, you know, all these kind of things. And there was really nothing out there. And so I reached, actually before that, so I had been doing a bunch of work with a lawyer at my old firm, growing her practice. She had gotten it going, and I became very instrumental in that and made her a lot of money. And was literally doing like 75 pitches a year. No exaggeration, I can tell you that, because I had to track it to explain to the firm that my non-billable time should be treated as valuable. They were like, everyone does pitches. I'm like, no. Like, here's the amount of revenue brought in from these pitches. Here's the number I did. And then I did all the work on the files too, and got no credit for it. So all that to say is I was tracking this and was like, well, I'm doing a lot of this, but I also was learning a lot on the fly, because you can really judge some of these reactions and trying different techniques. And really got into a good rhythm with this person. We were converting a healthy amount of these kind of leads. But I realized, like, there's got to be better ways out there. Like, there's people that do this for a living. And clearly we were doing some stuff right, but there was obviously a lot to learn. So I reached out to an old friend of mine a couple years ago named Dowell. We went to business school together, and he had spent a decade in the sales space and all sorts of different industries. And I was like, hey, like, where do I get started? Like, is there other books I should be reading? Are there podcasts? Like, what do I do? And so he gave me some stuff. And he sort of agreed to like unofficially do some coaching for me. And I was like, let me teach you the legal industry. There's actually an opportunity here for you. Like, the idea was not for me to do this. Long story short, when I left my old firm, I was like, why don't we do this together? Like, this seems like a better hybrid approach. Like, I know the legal space well. I've done a lot of business development in the space. You know the real world well. Let's combine this together and do some fun stuff. And so sort of went from having no clients, you know, of my own, maybe three or four, or like maybe like one or two small clients 3 or 4 years ago to like, I don't know, 50, 100 of my own clients these days, whole mix of like the smallest of small startups to a couple of companies that are worth billions of dollars. You know, some are great clients, some are not great clients, the whole range. And like when you start out, like you just take anything, right? So you're so desperate to try to do this. And, you know, your gut is telling you don't work with these clients. They're going to be a hassle and you don't listen to it. And then you're fighting on small amounts of money and it's a huge pain. But anyways, these days I thankfully am able to say no a bit better. But what I really learned along the way is there are best practices for this stuff and no one was teaching it to me. And there's also best practices when you're busy because like, you know, how do you spend your time becomes so important. But the other key piece that is a challenge for most lawyers, myself definitely included, is the mindset piece. And so with the work we do with a lot of lawyers, we work usually in cohorts, like small groups of like 6, 12 people. And the mindset piece is so important. Like it's not just teaching people best practices, of which most lawyers have none. They literally don't know the basics. Like it's almost laughable. But again, it's nobody's fault because where were we supposed to learn this? Law school didn't happen. Law firms, who has that skill set? But the mindset piece is huge because I think a lot of us develop, whether it's the imposter syndrome or don't believe what we're doing or the value we're going to charge, and we're our own worst salespeople. And so really getting over that mindset piece of like having the confidence, being okay with failure, not being a perfectionist because that is not a good skill in sales, and then be comfortable reaching out to people and asking and reconnecting with people you haven't talked to in a while. And so for me, that mindset piece was something I've worked really hard on because I would not have done a lot of this stuff a while ago. But really, it's best practices plus mindset and then having actually a game plan. And everything we teach is about modern, authentic business development. So not your sleazy used car salesman stuff, but really, how can I help people? How can I give and give and give? Expect nothing in return, but set yourself up and plant the right seeds so that you're really well positioned to get inbound referrals and build up a client base and enjoy the process of doing that and not see this as a chore.
No, Aaron, all of that is such great advice. And I think recently I've been really trying in my own life and in my own business to implement the mindset, like, if I don't ask or I'll never get. And so the other day I was approached with an opportunity for my business. And I thought that the opportunity, I was potentially getting a little bit lowballed. And so I made a huge ask in return. And sure enough, the email back didn't love that I had asked, but I got almost exactly what I'd asked for. And I was really scared to ask. And a couple people had said, maybe that's too big of an ask. But the worst thing that can happen is, I mean, I hope the worst thing that can happen is that someone says no. If there's something worse, don't tell me. But the worst thing that can happen is that someone says no. So all of that is really good advice. And I really love what you're saying about providing value and not expecting anything in return. I have been learning that that's such an important part of business development, and just really kind of showing up and doing what you can to give people a taste of what you provide in your paid content and sort of how you can help them grow outside of your free content as well. All of that is so great, Aaron. Thank you for sharing. So we're really curious, Aaron, you're deep in the legal tech space and like legal tech mindset of using tech to advance businesses and your practice. How do you see legal tech evolving over the next 5, 10 years? And what advancements do you think we've yet to see that you're really hoping change and materialize?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's not that I'm hesitant to guess, but it's almost like the biggest challenge right now is the tech is here and no one is using it. So I was on a call actually with someone else this morning. I think it was this morning, maybe it was yesterday. Everything's blending together. Pretty sure it was today though. And we were chatting about a legal tech idea he had, or like he wants to go down sort of path. And did I have any ideas? And I was saying to him, you know, often legal tech companies think, like, once they've sold their product into a firm and the firm is paying them, that they're in good shape. And I always say, like, that's not true, because the second thing is adoption at the firm. And if no one's using it, they're going to stop paying you in a year or whenever. And I think firms really struggle to roll out technology and help people understand it and then train people on it and track that. Not to mention, it takes a while to get tech in a firm. Like, the sales cycle is incredibly slow dealing with law firms. I know this from my own stuff, but also for legal tech, both with privacy concerns and just in general and all the skepticism and stuff. So there is so much legal tech out there that is just not being used, whether in-house, whether by firms, whether in taught in law schools. And there's just a lack of awareness. So step one is really getting people to know what's out there. Step two is getting people to use it. So, I mean, stuff that I've been using for like 5 years at least, that is, like, in my mind, table stakes, is not being widely used at a lot of firms. Or the firm has it, but like the people who should be using it don't even know it's there or have no idea how to use it. So I think it's less about what's going to be available, because there's going to be so many new advances, whether it's, you know, AI or this or that, and much more about, like, getting people to actually use it. And I'm a big believer in using legal tech for a few reasons. One is access to justice. Like, we charge a lot of money, so if we can do things more efficiently, we can serve, firstly, from a business development standpoint, you can access a whole new market of people. So, like, small businesses, like, I do a lot of work with small, medium-sized businesses who I can give great value to, but also great advice to, in a way that fits their budget. But more importantly, it's giving people what they need without sacrificing on quality. Or leveraging these things to, you know, do pro bono work or things like that, like, in scalable ways. But it also is way better for you as a lawyer. Like, if you're working too much, like, over the last 2 years, if firms had pre-pandemic actually adopted more tech, people wouldn't have had to work the ridiculous hours they worked, because so much of that work was due to inefficiency, due to lack of tech or lack of understanding things substantively. All that to say is, part of Foral Academy, what we do is we integrate legal tech into the courses. And so my view is, we got to teach you the what, so what you need to know, the why, so that's that big picture, that framework, that mental map, which is the key, and then the how, being how to do it in a modern way. And so, like, in the due diligence course I've been teaching, I work with three different legal tech companies in that class, and in some of them, the students are using the tech, like, it's hands-on. In our closings course, they're using one of the leading tools to close M&A deals, and they're being blown away by this stuff, and I sort of have forgotten what it's like to be in their shoes, because it's just, I'm like, man, like, your firm has this tech, or like, but no one knows how to use it properly. So it's really getting that adoption piece, getting people to understand what's out there. And we're running a bunch of free events too, just to keep people understanding more about what's out there and learning how to use it. Because this stuff is daunting. There is so much out there. It seems intimidating, but it's in your best interest. It's in the client's best interest. There's just so many benefits to using it. And that's what I'm hoping to see more of, is more adoption of stuff that's out there by firms, by in-house departments, and then more stuff that the public is able to take advantage of to get better value and all of that.
I have definitely noticed that. I was recently hanging out with one of my friends who works for a big law firm on Wall Street, and I walked past her computer and I was like, what in the heck are you guys using? And she's like, oh, yeah, we have to connect to the VPN and everything has to be super secure and, you know, all this stuff. And I was talking about different legal tech that I used and just not even a question of whether or not they would implement that due to privacy concerns and all these sorts of things. Is there anything, I don't know. I guess maybe that's a large question for the podcast, but I just wonder, like, is there any basis to this, or is it just like old school conservatism?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, are, like, we obviously have, you know, a lot of sensitive information, like some firms more than others, especially right. For, you know, like, you know, deals with really sensitive information. But that said, look, you know, like, most of our clients don't care. Like, the average client I'm working with is a tech company using all sorts of stuff. So if they're using this for their own stuff already, are they that fussed? And I mean, that's not the way a law firm traditionally wants to think about it. But at the same time, like, you've got to evolve. I mean, people made excuses not to move to the cloud for so long. And like, the cloud is generally so much more secure than their crappy on-premises servers. So all that to say is, you know, there's different things. There's privacy concerns in some provinces like BC and I think out east, New Brunswick or something. If you're dealing with governments, they had some ridiculous privacy law rules that were super dated. So like, there was an excuse there. And then there's the Patriot Act in the US and there's excuses. But at the end of the day, like, you know, you've got to evolve and you've got to take some level of risk. And I mean, your clients are using this stuff. This stuff is probably more secure than what you're using. And you need to do your diligence, but there's a point in time at which you have to say, like, we need to use this to evolve. And eventually we're not going to be able to compete I think until firms are really feeling things, you know, on the bottom line, which is ages away, they're not going to feel that urgency. But I think it's frustrating a lot of younger lawyers or people in general who want to be using this stuff and are being told like you can't use this. And it probably also leads lawyers to use stuff they're not supposed to use. I was certainly no stranger to using plenty of things that I wasn't allowed to use because I had no choice. I'm like, I cannot run my practice. I was working on like 15 different files a day. And if I wasn't going to get access to modern practice project management software, I was going to be negligent and miss a lot of deadlines. So the way I saw it was my choice was negligence or potential privacy risk using leading software used by, you know, thousands of top companies around the world. It was a pretty obvious choice on my end. But if I'm a firm, I probably don't want that. Ironically, like we use that software at my firm today because it's the leading software out there for project management and the security is good, but there's always risk with things, but there's also, you know, risk with the status quo. And I think sometimes people don't give the status quo the same shake that they do when they're thinking about onboarding new tech or new ways of doing things. And I think we got to look at things a little bit more objectively through that lens.
That is definitely a good thing to consider when you're looking at the pros and cons of trying something new or doing the status quo. So thanks for kind of breaking that down for us because I was always sort of curious about that. But what has been one of the most significant setbacks you faced, you know, besides crummy software in your career? And what did you learn from it?
Plenty of setbacks. I think most, if I wasn't passionate about what I was doing, I would have quit most of these things ages ago. You know, you talked earlier about mentorship, having good mentors, which I had some great ones, and lack of mentorship, which definitely had a lot of that too, and lack of support or sponsorship. And there were certainly a lot of people telling me what I was doing was nuts, but also not to do it, prohibiting me from doing it, doing everything possible to prevent me from doing it. Really doing some stuff that was not great that I'm not going to get into here, but let's just say it was not the easiest path to push forward with the stuff I wanted to do. Like I knew what I was doing made sense and was right, but I was certainly not in an environment that necessarily was conducive to that. And there were people who were very excited to try to see me fail. So sort of persevering on that and just sticking to my guns and knowing like, look, I know I'm right. I know I'm right because I'm talking to a lot of people and I'm hearing the same things. And I think the challenge in this industry, and we see this with the bar exam stuff that happened this week, is if you don't have the right people at the table, if you're not asking for honest feedback, if you're not providing mechanisms for people to give that feedback, then what you hear is an echo chamber of people who agree with you. And that's a huge, huge problem. And I think in this industry, we have a lack of diversity in general. Obviously, there's gender issues, there's racial issues. Those are a fact, and I'm not disputing those. There's just a lack of people with experience outside this industry and a lack of fresh ideas. And so what you have is a really insular group of people that have been elevated to leadership positions that do not know anything about modern leadership. And I'm no expert, but I read a lot about this stuff because I have to be. Like I'm running businesses. How do I learn how to do this? I've read a lot of entrepreneurship books in the last year because I have no idea how to do this. Same with leadership. So, you know, it's not hard to find leading stuff. You can listen to like, you know, Adam Grant or Brené Brown's podcast. You can read those books. Like, but leadership has changed a lot in the last, you know, couple decades, like best practices. And obviously we've got massive generational differences in terms of expectations of hours, of being treated certain ways. If you don't have diversity of age or diversity of people from different backgrounds, they're just not going to know this because they didn't grow up with this in law firms or in-house because these people usually came from law firms. And I think that's an enormous challenge right now. So there's a lot of people who are frustrated because they have ideas, they're not feeling heard. And so really like at my current firm, for example, trying to make sure everyone feels heard, everyone's got an opportunity to speak up. And that like, we want the best ideas and that's it. We don't care who they come from. And I don't think the industry is ready to hear ideas from people unless they've been elevated to a certain level or they've proven themselves for a few decades, which is just ridiculous in general.
I feel like I have spent this entire conversation sitting here nodding. I could not agree more with so much of what you've just said, Erin. Thank you so much for sharing and for enlightening us today. We always like to end the podcast with the same question, which is we would love to know something new you've learned recently, whether that's something about business or something quirky and weird. We are here for it all.
Yeah, I've been learning a lot recently. I've been reading a lot of books. So lots of stuff about entrepreneurship for sure, like modern leadership, entrepreneurship, learning a lot about hiring people and firing people and stuff and like really trying to embrace radical candor and, you know, doing the hard stuff, having these hard conversations. And really just, yeah, like, how do you run and scale a business in a way where you can feel comfortable delegating and doing all these things and really thinking from a systems lens? So as I say these days, I'm trying to be more like McDonald's, which sounds like, you know, no one really aspires to be McDonald's, but McDonald's, you know, you get a pretty consistent product, not that I eat there. It's run by a bunch of people who are not necessarily the highest skilled or most experienced people. And yet it's a billion-dollar business. And it's because they have really good systems and then they just have people to work those systems. And so really thinking about everything I do as I try to scale these various companies, my own practice, whatever, how do I build the systems so that I can not do all the work, but yet clients can still get the same kind of quality? So whether it's teaching new instructors through 4L Academy, like we're systematizing it and we're figuring all that out, whether it's through Build Your Book, again, like how do we do that? How do we scale? And especially at our law firm, how do we systematize, firstly, the legal work? I don't mean automating everything. I just mean like when you go to a different lawyer at a firm, and this is true at big firms and small firms, you shouldn't get a different experience. Like, why will they give you a different document? Like, that's not good. That's a flaw in the legal profession. And so how do we create and ensure high quality for all our clients, no matter who they're working with? How on the back end do we ensure that we're not missing things and that we're doing a good job? You know, if someone joins the firm, if someone leaves. So really thinking from a systems lens, which has been a big shift for me. Not that I didn't think that way traditionally, but like that is my number one focus. How do we systematize this so that we can scale, so that we can do all these things? And that is not something that the legal profession is known for, and is definitely not something you learn in law school or at the average firm. So that's been a really big learning for me.
Well, I love that idea, mostly because I love McDonald's and I do eat there a lot, at least once a week. It's a running joke in my household that if my boyfriend says that I get to pick lunch, that I will come back with McDonald's. And I'll come back with like iced coffees because I am low-key obsessed with the iced coffees. McDonald's, if you're listening, please sponsor me. I will drink like a vat of that iced coffee, honest to God. But I really like that visual. So I'm here for the McDonald's systemization.
Awesome. Aaron, thank you so much for spending time with us today. You have given us so much to think about. I know that I'm going to have to go through my bookshelf, read some of the books about entrepreneurship that have been sitting there that I have yet to read because, you know, sometimes it's hard to make the time. But thank you so much for coming and being an inspiration. Seriously, if you are listening and you haven't checked out Aaron's LinkedIn posts, you've got to follow along. But to stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast and stay tuned for our next episode coming next Tuesday.
Bye. Awesome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you again to our partner, LawBroker, Legal's first customer experience platform powered by lawyers. To learn more, visit lawbroker.com and see how you can join the movement to become a modern lawyer.